For sure.
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 Welcome to another episode of For Sure, a 200-foot podcast. It's me, Jay. Now, usually that would be Pete saying those things, and then I would chime in, and then we get the episode started. But for just the second week in a row, we have another special episode for you. That's right. Pete's on the road. He decided to fold up his picnic cloth and tie it to his walking stick and thumbed a ride up to Rochester for the Rochester Institute of Technology's Sports Analytic Conference. Now I know what you're saying. Hey, 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 it's Ritzak. First rule of Ritzak is you don't talk about Ritzak. And if you talk about it, you have to use a graph talking about how you don't talk about Ritzak. But I'm going to break the rules here and actually talk about it. So it's a industry event that allows students, faculty, and anyone interested in seeing how statistical analysis is being implemented in, you know, hashtag sports. Our roving road reporter Pete Flynn was able to gain entry into this Valhalla feast to pick the brains of some of the people that were presenting. So we've got a couple of really cool interviews coming up for you guys. We've got some fun stuff from Matthew Barlow and CJ Taturo, who were there to present for a Tableau workshop. And then we've also got Matt Kane, who was speaking on some curling analytics. From what I gather from Twitter, tiaras were involved. But that's something I guess we'll get into a little bit later. So in an effort to speed things along here, because we know you want to listen to what these people have to say, I'm going to toss to my broadcast partner, Pete, who will introduce some fun interviews that you guys can enjoy, and we'll see you on the other side.
Our guest today is Matt Kane. We're sitting at a table at RIT. We are on break for lunch for the RIT Sports Analytics Conference, and Matt has graciously offered to give up a little bit of his lunch to be with us today. So how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. I gave up a bit of my lunch, but I kind of snuck lunch in, and I've done my presentation. So
yeah.
So the day is smooth from here.
Yeah. Actually, let's just jump into that. So your presentation was on curling, and not cricket, like I said last night, which is another sport that starts with C that I don't know much about. But I think it's fun to watch, but I don't really understand it too much. What was the most interesting thing that you found in doing the research for this? And did it make you more interested in the sport than you were when you started out?
Yeah, definitely. I think I was a little worried when I started doing the research because it was after I had proposed to Ryan to present something here. So there was a lot of pressure to find something or anything. It really was interesting to start to get into some of the shot-by-shot level data and to look at, you know, if you lead with a guard or if you lead with a draw, how does that impact the rest of the end? I think in terms of practical things, the thing that most challenged my like understanding of curling was really learning that blanking the first end, and for like non-curling folks, this is probably not going to mean anything. Blanking the first end wasn't necessarily as dominant a strategy as I think a lot of people view it as. And you get similar results if you score one and much better results if you score two. So it was fun. It was cool to like learn in more detail a new sport and to sort of challenge myself to get out of the hockey world for a little bit.
Yeah. I just realized that I didn't really give a proper introduction, so let me just do that real quick. So
curling analyst.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So if there's any listeners, if you're into stats and analytics about hockey at all, like I imagine you probably know who Matt is, but just in case you don't, you can find him on Twitter at Kane_Matt. So that's Kane_MATT. He has a bachelor's degree in engineering and management from McMaster University and a master of science in applied math from Ryerson University. So his level of math is a lot higher than mine. He is currently a data scientist at a nonprofit, and you could read his work at a lot of different places, Hockey Graphs. I know last year in Hockey Abstract, you had an article on Power Plays.
Yep.
I think we'll probably get to that later because I thought it was really interesting, and I definitely wanted to ask about that. Let's just keep it on the topic of the conference for now. So we're sitting here at lunch. It's 12:30. And we've had a bunch of presentations. And this year, instead of it being the Hockey Analytics Conference, it's the Sports Analytics Conference. So we have presentations from different sports and, you know, brought in different people. So what have been, like, the highlights of the presentations so far? I mean, there's a lot to choose from. Like, you know, like, what was, like, your, this is awesome?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a really, this conference is always really great and brings like a wide variety of people together who, you know, offer a lot of different things. I love Seth Partnow's presentation, which was the last one right before, just on what it's like working in a front office and sort of the like, how do you add value? Because that's really applicable across, you know, any sport. And really is, I mean, even if you're not working in a front office, I think it's a good model for how you can present your work to the public.
Yeah.
And how you can really like not overload your audience, who are generally going to not have spent as much time thinking about the problem as you have.
Yeah.
But a good way to emphasize how to communicate to them. I thought Jesse McNulty's talk on lacrosse analytics, and I can't share the details of it, was really interesting.
Yeah.
Is all proprietary. But just the hockey stuff was really cool because it showed to me that we've moved a little bit beyond everyone just coming and presenting their new like player model. We're getting a lot more into tactics and systems and thinking about really how do we add value at the coaching or at the player level rather than just the management and the decision level. And both are like really interesting problems to solve.
Yeah.
It's just that we were really lacking in that area before, and it's been really great to see Ian's presentation and Ryan and Matt and Judy and Chris and everyone who talked this morning.
Yeah.
And CJ. I don't want to leave anyone out.
I mean, of course, Chris pretty much started off with Matt Cain as a god, so
I had
a little biased, but yeah.
I had to like that one because he complimented me, but he also talked about a topic that was near and dear to my heart, which is aggressive play and four forwards. And
right. The conversation with Seth made me think of something that, like, one of the questions I wrote down before. You know, one of the things that, you know, if you recognize Matt's name, you probably know him for is the free agent salary projection model. So, one thing that I always find interesting, which is something that I kind of was thinking about while Seth was talking, is, like, for example, two days ago, we were talking in our Slack channel about, hey, you know, Dylan Larkin still hasn't signed. We really should, and Prashanth was kind of like the proponent of this. He's like, you know, I used to think that signing into a long-term deal was the way to go, but now I really think that a three-year deal would probably be better. And I started off, I was like, no, I mean, that's not true. And then I spent like 5 hours yesterday or 2 days ago writing the article. And as I was doing it, I was like, if he signs before I publish this, all this work is for nothing. But you know, so I'm going through, and like one thing that I've really tried to work on as a writer is presenting the information in a way that's both going to be like complete enough. Like I'm not just like, you know, giving the basic details. I'm giving like some in-depth stuff. But if you're a reader who doesn't really know, okay, this model or whatever, like a way that they can kind of understand it. So like that's what I was thinking when he was writing that. So one of the things is, like, I always, you know, often I'll refer to your model either like on the podcast or in an article. And one thing I'm always like, I really want to make sure I'm describing it accurately. So, because I know there's definitely some misconceptions about like what the model shows. So, like, how would you describe it?
So, I think the simplest way to describe it is it's a model that tries to predict what a player is going to be paid. And that's not necessarily what they're going to be worth if you think about, like, if there were a constant dollars to wins conversion that you could do. You would look at that and say, you know, we predicted, let's say Dylan Larkin as an example, would get $6.5 million on a 5-year deal.
Yeah.
That doesn't necessarily mean he's going to offer that much value, but players who have performed similarly to Dylan Larkin in the past have gotten contracts that, on average, come out to around $6.5 million if they sign to a long-term deal.
Yeah.
Obviously, if it's shorter, it's going to be a different prediction because the model really relies heavily on what the term is and tries to predict the term, but isn't really as good at that. But ultimately, it's trying to think through the thought process that a GM goes through when they decide to sign a player to a contract and say, where do we think they're going to end up from that regard?
Yeah. Because I think like in writing the article, one of the things that I was like kind of really thinking about is there's a big difference between like, okay, how many centers in the NHL get paid? Because your estimation was like, I went with 6 by 6.3. That was your model's estimation for a 6-year deal. And, you know, there's this many centers that make, I think it's like 23 centers or something like that. And then I made this, it's an estimate, it's like not a perfect thing. But there was an article a while ago, I think it was like Maple Leafs Hot Stove or something like that, where they used, at the time, I think they used DTM's GAR model.
Oh, yeah.
And they said, okay, like, you know, we can see how many goals above replacement were scored in the NHL last year. And we can see how much did NHL GMs pay everybody. And so we can come up with a rough estimate. Like, okay, they had this many goals above replacement, so they provided this much value. It's not perfect. You know, like, in my articles, I'm like, this isn't perfect, but it's kind of good. You know, it's at least close. And it was interesting because 24 centers, according to that, provided it ended up being 6.1 million because there was no difference. Yeah. But then the interesting thing was like number 23, like I took Manny's player ratings for centers, right? And number 23 was Logan Couture and number 24 is John Tavares. And I mean, there were a couple names on the top 24 where I was like, I think Larkin could be that good.
Yeah.
But like, I was just like, And I was going in expecting to find something else. And I ended up really enjoying writing the article because I was like, I'm glad, like, I didn't just go with my bias. You know, and I thought, like, I think that's important, yeah.
It's, yeah, I mean, that's ultimately, it's what we're aiming to do in the long run, but it's also really difficult to remove your bias, especially when, you know, we're working with incomplete data sets and you do have to come up with rough estimates. Like,
yeah.
Like you said, like you put a rough number on it and you acknowledge that it's not perfect,
yeah.
But it does allow you to do a little bit better decision making by taking this broad estimate in general. And so it's never going to be a perfect science. And you can obviously, if you stick to your bias, you can just tweak that number or whatever analysis you're doing to make it show that point. But you really have to be willing to say, you know, this is where the evidence has led me and here are some of the reasons why it might be wrong, but this is ultimately the best analysis that I think can be done.
So in the past, because I know, you know, on your, like on the sheet, if anybody's interested, tweet to me and I'll send you the link to the model. I'll put it in the show notes too. You know, so as a contract is entered, you put it up there like, you know, here's what it is. So when there's like a big difference, you know, like, I just want to double check before I say this because I have a feeling there's going to be a big difference. Yeah, Tom Wilson. I figured. So predicted AAV $3.5 million. Obviously, you signed for a lot more than that. Now, I don't want to begin a big Tom Wilson debate because honestly, I'm tired of hearing the name Tom Wilson after Twitter and Slack and everything. But when there's a contract like that or something similar where like your model is like way off, is there Like, have you found a reason or reasons that seem to come up the most, like a certain type of player, or maybe like the team is in a certain situation where they need to win now and they're going to overpay, or
definitely the things that come up the most are that sort of veteran players or players who have had a lot of tenure with a team. Teams tend to value them a lot more than perhaps an external team would. I suspect that there's a lot of value, and I haven't actually confirmed this. A lot of differences in contracts may also come down to things like how do they perform in the playoffs? How did the team do relative to where they were expected to do? One thing that is not included in my model, but that I think is kind of an important indicator is, like, what's a player's rank on the team? Like, are they the player that's expected to go out there and play top 6 minutes, even if they wouldn't necessarily be a top 6 player on another team? Because teams tend to want to hang on to those players. And unfortunately, it's probably just a bit of, like, the bias of you have this asset now and you don't want to get rid of it. But those things are a little bit more difficult to model. So going into the Tom Wilson negotiations, like, not to rehash this, you kind of know that the model has blind spots to players like him. And so it's difficult sometimes to communicate on Twitter that, hey, you know, it's a model, it's not perfect.
Yeah.
And here are some of the reasons why it's not going to be perfect. But you try to do your best.
Yeah, because I mean, one thing that can be kind of annoying for me is, you know, as somebody who, you know, tries to do, you know, tries my best to do analysis using, you know, your model and, like, Manny's stuff. And, you know, like, I'm not to the point where I can make my own stuff, but, like, you know, I try to do my best with, you know,
yeah,
interpreting and using it as analysis. Is, like, no matter how hard I try to be, like, this is not cut and dry. You know, like, in the Dylan Larkin article, there was, I used Dom Gallimini's chart, where, like, it's, like, attempting to predict future scoring success, right? First line, second line, third line. And so the chart is like Dylan Larkin is like 33% first line, 67% second line. And so like I'm presenting it as like, you know, this indicates it's more likely that he will be a second line center. That doesn't mean he can't be a first line center. I mean, you know, we got Philip Zadina. He ends up playing with Zadina. You never know what's going to happen because Larkin's a very good playmaker. You know, he's turned from a scorer into like an assist man.
Yeah.
And so now he has an elite sniper. There's a real case to be made that he could jump 20, 25 points. Like, it's not unheard of. But at the same time, the data indicates that it's more like that he's going to be a second-line center. And then in the comments, like, people are, like, weaponizing my thing. It's like, well, Peter said 66%. I'm like, yeah, but like, there's context. Like, I wrote 2,300 words so that I could put all the context in. So, like, do you ever find that happening where, like, you realize somebody's using your good for evil?
I think it happens a lot. People, even people who know that it's not an absolute prediction and that there's a margin of error or there's, you know, a range of possibilities for any given outcome, it's easier for the human brain to understand a single number, a binary yes, no. 67% becomes 100%. You look at, like, election forecasting. People take 67% to mean 100%.
Oh, God.
But it's you ultimately have to, I mean, what I found is just kind of keep trying to bring people along, and hopefully, you know, I don't think you'll ever get rid of the group that says, that thinks only in black and white and only in absolutes, but eventually I think you can get to the point where you have to explain that it's a probability less, and ultimately there's, what I find a little odd is that the group that argues hockey is too fast moving, there's too many unknowns and things that, you know, can't be measured, is also the same group that, like, has a lot of trouble with, like, uncertainty and the idea that this is a prediction, but there's a whole, like, range of outcomes that might happen, and aren't willing to say, you know, this is what we think the most likely outcome is, but it could be wide either way. It's odd to me that I've found at least that those are often similar groups of people who respond with those sorts of comments.
I actually, I'm not sure if this person, I've never seen this person before, but they're in my mentions, and I'm not sure if they listen to this podcast, and if they do, I guess I'm kind of audibly subtweeting it, but I'm not going to say the account. And like the person replied, I forget if it was like to my article or something, like basically saying, you know, by the end of the contract, you know, a $6.1 million cap hit could feel like 4.5 or so, like whatever the numbers were. And like, I did the math and I wrote back, the cap would have to be $109 million.
Yeah.
And he's like, I think that's excessive. I'm like, no, it's math. Like, here's how you do it. You know, like this isn't like subjective. This is like literally this percentage of, you know, the cap would have to be $109 million for that percentage to be equivalent, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's the tough thing is that there are some things that are actually absolutes. And
right.
If you spend so much time talking about probability, then sometimes it's hard to shift people back into that mode. But yeah, it's there's definitely times where the answer isn't a complex model with statistical uncertainties. It's here's the raw math of how that would work.
So, you know, on our podcast, it's me, but we also have Jay as our co-host. And just because of logistics, you know, he wasn't able to be here, and you know, there wasn't really a good way to kind of pipe him in.
Yeah.
So over the you know, the length of the podcast, I think we've definitely established that we have different types of questions and different, you know, different styles, and I think it works best with that. So I asked Jay for a few questions.
Awesome.
So these next three, unless I ask a follow up, are from Jay. Right. So for our listeners, if you've been waiting for Jay questions, there are no Jersey ones. Jay is a Jersey aficionado.
Oh, okay.
And it's fun because I could not care less about Jersey. I'm like, yeah, that's cool. You know, and he'll talk for 20 minutes about like piping or like, you know, the shoulders or something, you know. Okay, so the first one from him is, what's the one piece of info that you wish was constant or more solid that would make a model or a predictor easier to prove? So like, what's like the X factor variable that would make things clearer, like in a perfect world, like if you were able to access something or have a certain type of piece of data that would help predict things better, I guess.
So if I'll start by saying for my contract model, if I had like every team's internal scouting database, I think I could do a lot better than really it's doing now, just because that database is going to be, it's going to be stats plus subjective opinions, and those together are going to do, I think, a lot better than necessarily, you know, you're doing with just stats. I think in terms of predicting like player performance, obviously the holy grail is player tracking data. I think the difficulty with that is really it's going to be information overload, and it's how do you, you know, the people who say hockey's too complex to model, they're correct that it's very complex, but probably not too complex to model. And so I think when that data comes out there, and you know, we have enough of it to actually build a model, there's going to be a bit of an arms race for who can figure out the correct way to turn these millions and millions of measurements per game into something slightly more understandable that's also predictive. And then figuring out, you know, how you sort of merge that basic information together to think about how different players will play together.
Yeah. I mean, I've started to try to, you know, get into, you know, using R to do some things. And, like, I'm to the point, like, I mean, when I was growing up, I would do, like, I think, like, C++. So I have, like, some kind of computer programming experience, but it's been a long time. And, you know, I'm still, like, at a very, very basic level. But I remember, I think it was, like, Money Pucker. Like, there was a website where they're like, hey, we have, like, every shot for, and I'm like, awesome. I have no idea what to do with that. Like, it just seems like so much information.
I was just going to say, the trouble is that I think it was like a million shots or something with like 700 variables for each one.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a difficult balance to strike because you don't want to be the person who's necessarily going through and picking out and saying, these three variables are all that matters.
Yeah.
But you do need to apply a certain amount of human judgment into how you're developing the model to make sure that it makes sense and you're not missing really something obvious. Like if you include block shots in that and you try to predict the probability that it's a goal based on, you know, the type of shot, obviously block shots and misses and everything aren't going to be, you can build a perfect model if you know exactly what happened as a predictor. So there's difficulties with even the data we have now narrowing it down.
All right, so another Jay question. I have a feeling he was looking at your Twitter bio. All right, so as a lover of puns,
yes.
Oh. Do you find yourself frequently at odds with yourself about inserting puns into your work?
I don't know that I ever hold myself back too much. I think I try to limit myself to a handful in the intro and then just getting that out of the way. But it's never stopped me from tweeting one. I tend to just like play to my audience there, who seem to be split 50-50 on puns versus no puns. I think I have a few pun focused followers. But I also have people who tell me to stop.
Like give
repeatedly.
Us our puns. Give us our puns.
Yeah.
I mean, I was sitting, you know, watching your curling thing. I was waiting for a please hammer, don't hurt them. Like headline.
Yeah. I saw your tweet and I had wish I saw it like when I still had time to edit my slides. I would have paused my talk to add that in.
Yeah, one thing for our listeners about this this conference that I learned last year is that there's people I know and I'm like, oh, that's that person and that's Michael Blake McCurdy, etc. But then like creeping in the shadows, there's like, oh, he's a director for the Hurricane, you know, and like because of that, I limit, like, I always have questions I would like to ask as a joke, and I'm like, that person might, like, want to hire me one day. So, like, you know, I mean, it's a long shot, but, you know, you don't want to throw that away. But I had a really good question about Fortnite and CHL data with the esports guy.
Oh, I thought you were going to ask me that question.
No.
I don't know anything about
Fortnite. Oh, I don't
know
anything either. I would just remember, you know, there was the Jeff Merrick blind item about the CHL prospects
who
plays too much Fortnite.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But I figured like somebody here might know that person. So, all right. So Jay's final question is, this is a tough one, I think. What is the most essential stat? So like something we currently have, that if it didn't exist would make the analytics world fall into pieces. Like, so I guess what's the most essential stat? That's a tough one, yeah.
It's difficult. I think the most essential piece of data that we have right now is the shot attempt data. So if you didn't have, I guess the answer is Corsi. There's really not much we could do. We would be relying back again on, you know, plus minus and goals and maybe like goal for percentage rel. Save percentage rel might be a lot more popular of a stat than perhaps it is these days. I think that's probably kind of the basis piece of information that it would be really hard to work without. I think, you know, there is an argument to be made that some of the single number metrics, so stuff like game score, war, point shares, Manny's star rating, stuff like that, that information is really useful for like doing analysis on top of to really push the field further. So you can do things like calculating the cost of a win or stuff like that and start to do more team management, salary cap management, projections outwards, where if you didn't have like a single number that you trust to be player talent or player contribution, it's a lot harder to kind of smush a whole bunch of different stats into one to write those types of articles where you say, you know, they're going to be overpaying for their forward group in 3 years because we project that they're downhill from here.
Yeah. You know, we still have about 5 minutes, so we had a really good mailbag question from one of our listeners, and I really liked it. So it's from Ryan, who is MTU Moose. So first of all, thanks, Ryan, for giving us a question to ask. So it's kind of similar to one of the questions Jay asked, but I think it's different enough, and I think it's something that I think people who are like, they're like, okay, I see all these stats, and I'm like overwhelmed, right? So his question is, what do you think are like the top three metrics an average fan should understand? So like, that, you know, if you only have time to really look at like three different things, because he says like, I see all sorts of different metrics that get thrown around, I don't have time to study them all. So which ones provide the best bang for the buck in understanding players in the NHL?
So I don't know if this is a cop-out answer or not, but I'm going to list like a broad group of stats I'm going to call Corsi one stat when it's really like three or four.
That's okay, yeah.
I think understanding Corsi, I think understanding expected goals, and I think a really important stat, or less a stat, but like concept to understand, is how a lot of the new war models work. Mm. Just in terms of what the inputs are, most of them are regression-based, and so to have a general understanding of what the model itself is trying to do, what it's trying to create when it's going through all of its iterations and tweaking parameters and everything, really having an understanding of that will be really important for, number one, using those numbers correctly, because they're very powerful numbers, but they're also numbers that have, you know, significant limitations in that we can only model with a limited subset of the data that we have, and there's a lot of assumptions that go into it. So you need to understand those to properly interpret the results, which I think is kind of, you know, the ongoing war battle that we're having in the analytics community. Like, the answer isn't war is great or war is terrible. The answer is that war is good in some situations and bad in others, and these are the reasons why.
Yeah.
But that's not that doesn't fit in 200 and whatever characters.
Right, and it's like, you know, I remember when I first started using Manny's model, like, I read the short version, and then I clicked on the one where it's like, you know, here's the longer. I was like, oh my, I have, like, I'm just going to trust the people I know who know a lot more than me have read this, and they say it makes sense. So. All right, so I got two more questions, right?
Awesome.
We'll wrap it up. So I know I'm like far from the first person to talk about this. Do you think there'll ever be a shift from talking about AAV to talking about percentage of cap hit?
I would guess that in front offices, that's probably the way a lot of the conversations go. I would hope in front offices that's part of the way the conversations go. I was actually thinking about this problem a little bit today, thinking about my contract model. The way I model it actually models player salary as a percentage between 0 and 1, where 0 is league minimum and 1 is the maximum in the year that they sign, which I think gives, because the minimum is a percentage of the maximum that is shifted around, it's purely a modeling technique, but it makes it a little easier. One thought that I had is really thinking about that percentage of cap in terms of how much you could actually bury in the AHL and subtracting that away.
That's interesting.
Mostly because, like, a player who has a contract for like $1.5 million versus, let's say, $4.5 million, you know, that $1.5 million is really only, let's say, $500,000 in dead space that's there no matter what versus $4 million in dead space that's there no matter what. So I don't know if that's necessarily going to add any value in analyzing teams, but I'm certainly hopeful that we do start talking about that, because I think a lot of people get sort of anchored on the numbers. And I think players and teams do too. And they, you know, say like Dylan Larkin's making 6.1 and I'm as the same as Dylan Larkin, and so it's 3 years later and I'll take 6.1 when really it should be 6.5, 7.
All right, so yeah, so the last question. So like I said before, you know, I really liked your power play piece in last year's Hockey Abstract. I guess it's a two-part question. So what were both the biggest takeaways that you found in doing the research, and what was like the biggest surprise that you found in doing that research?
So one of the, I guess, the two takeaways that I think are the biggest are, number one, four forward defensemen, and I wrote about this a while ago, but four forward defensemen, or four forward power play units, tend to do better than three forward units do. It's not like a super novel or like unique concept, but it is one that the difference is big enough that it should be noticeable to teams, and teams at least at this point should be moving towards it, which they have been, but it should be more significant. Another interesting thing I found was researching on power play structure, where I came up with a metric to look at the consistency of a power play. And it did seem to be predictive of future results, where power plays that were more consistent in how they were generating opportunities were also the power plays that tended to do better in the future. So those were kind of two things that stood out. I was a little surprised that structure, I think when I ran it in like a multivariate regression alongside, you know, shot generation or expected goals, was roughly as important or maybe a little less important than shot generation, because I really thought ultimately it's about getting shots regardless of where they're from, but there is, I guess, a little bit of extra information in how you're generating them.
Again, thank you so much for taking time out. We were kind of talking about this before, that one of the things that I've found really great is that, you know, you come here and you're like, oh man, I know that guy, like, you know, and everybody's like so like really nice and friendly, and so it's been really fun, you know, to talk to people.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's been great. It's been fun to chat. And I'd echo, like, to any of your listeners who are, like, interested in coming out to these, like, they're really amazingly social events where everyone just, you know, loves talking about sports or hockey in general. And even if you don't know anyone there, you're going to meet a lot of people who share the same passion about you and really just want to talk about hockey for hours on end. So.
So again, just so I don't forget, you can follow Matt on Twitter. It is at @CANE_MATT. Thanks again, and enjoy the rest of the conference.
Yeah, thanks a lot. You too.
Okay, so we are still at Rochester. RITSAC, RIT, Sports Analytics Conference has just wrapped up. We just had the last presentation. And so two people were kind enough to join me. So we have CG Turturro and Matt Barlow. They did a workshop the first night on Tableau, which is a data visualization site. You've seen a lot of Tableau stuff on Twitter and in articles. So first of all, obviously for both of you, thank you so much for doing this.
No problem.
Because there's two people, just so our listeners can identify the voices, I'm just going to introduce you separately. All right. So first we have CJ. You can follow him on Twitter @CJTDevil. And so he is a quote-unquote hockey analytics guy, according to his Twitter. And he is a contributor to the SB Nation New Jersey site. So CJ, how are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good.
Yeah?
Thanks for having us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you. And then Matt, he, again, quote-unquote, makes charts for the Hurry Corsi graphic games, which made me laugh a lot. And he does Python, SQL, R, Tableau. You know, he does a bunch of stuff. So, Matt, how are you doing today?
I'm good. I actually don't make any charts for the Hurricanes anymore these days. I need to update my bio. But if the fancy strikes me, I'll make a chart. But normally, I'm not as chart-centric.
Luckily, I am still a fancy stats guy.
Yes.
So, I'm just going to get started with like a couple kind of conference related questions. All right. So now, you know, we've seen all the presentations. We've been, you know, been here for all the speakers. So what did you guys think was, you know, maybe like your top couple presentations of, for any reason? It could have been like, maybe it was like something you had no idea before, and now you're like, oh, that was cool. I learned something I had no idea about, or you had a deeper understanding of something you already knew. Like, so however you want to go with that.
I've got two that come to mind quickly, which was the NWHL one. I really enjoyed. There was a presentation on the National Women's Hockey League. That was from a fellow SB Nationer, I think, right? Oh no, that was a
is it? I thought it works for Blue Shirt Banner.
Blue Shirt Banner. Yeah. So that, you know, just the it's exciting to be involved at, you know, getting at the ground level of a new budding league like that. And trying to be, you know, a pioneer of the statistics movement, and seeing I think it was Mike, right? Mike Murphy, I think, present about that was really interesting. And then there was the other one that was kind of just talking about how you should be an analytics person on a team, right?
Seth Partner.
That one was a really strong finish to like the first segment. So those two. I think were probably my favorites. And I think I did a pretty excellent job.
For people that aren't familiar, Seth Partnow is an analytics guy for the Milwaukee Bucks. So he was kind of limited in what he could actually say, mm-hmm. but what he did kind of touches on a lot of points that people who work in analytics should mm-hmm. probably do. For me, I was really, there's a guy who came in and did a lacrosse
mm-hmm.
Speech. I'm looking up his name because I want to give him credit because it was so good. He's talking about how they built the stats for the Professional Lacrosse League in America, like basically from scratch. Like there's no one doing it. How he's trained people to count the stats, and then they're inserting them to the database. They're doing
Jesse McNulty.
Yes, Jesse McNulty. How they're creating their databases. It's just really interesting to see, like, just starting from the ground up, basically the bottom, you know, and then building it up. And he also showed how they are, like, even ahead of the NHL, they're putting cameras in their stadiums and tracking players that way.
That was a pretty common thread over the course of the whole day, was everyone begging the NHL to get on there.
Everyone was just, like, dumping on the NHL for their statistics. And, I mean, it's valid, yes. Their statistics are pretty bad. But it's also, they are public too. So, I mean, for as bad as they are, I will give them credit for at least still making them public. Also, I believe, Yurko was talking about the
NFL has a lot of
proprietary stats. And while you see that somewhat in NHL, it's not near as prevalent.
Mm. Agreed.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, I definitely agree with you guys on, you know, the presentations you said. I think, if I remember correctly, I know in the interview with Matt earlier, we were talking about the Seth Partnow presentation. Because, I mean, even though it wasn't directly about hockey.
It's just so important for all of the, you know, hockey analytics people or sports analytics people to know so that.
And I think it's even more helpful because it applies to writing hockey articles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for somebody like me who's not really doing a lot of work in creating data and things like that. I'm just using it. I'm like, you know, using it to support my points and do research and, you know, try to come to a logical conclusion about a question. Or if you're doing visualization, you know, it's the same type of things where you're like,
you know, how can I present this most effectively? And actually, I think we were talking about that last night, where, you know, the idea of sometimes, like, and I know this is a problem I kind of ran into, is where, like, sometimes you want to put so much, like, you have so much stuff you want to put out there that you end up running the risk of just having so much information that the reader has no idea what to focus on.
Yeah, I think another part of his speech that definitely I've taken to heart a lot more recently is just the humility part of it, just, like, realizing that what you do is not set in stone, like any sort of analytics. Because when I first started out, like, I was so excited about analytics. I was coming up with all these answers. I had all the answers.
Of course, he's
always right. You're dumb. And so, obviously, like, if you know, like, interacted with me on Twitter like two and a half years ago, you probably would have thought I'm not a nice person. And that had been a true thing. But I've definitely, as the more I've learned, the more I've learned how little I actually know as well. You become more and uncertain of your findings, and it's always a good idea to just carry that uncertainty with you when you're doing any sort of analytical.
Unless you're on Reddit, in which case.
You know. Yeah, if it's anonymous, just whatever. But I've always tried to build, like, some people are anonymous on Twitter, which is fine. I've always tried to build a, I am who I am. Like, I'm on Twitter. Mm-hmm. You're getting me.
Yeah, both of us are. You're Matt Barlow on Twitter. I'm CJ Tutorial on Twitter.
Yeah,
right?
So
nonsense.
Me too. I mean, I use my real name.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So for a long time, I did. Because I had a pen name. Like, I used to, when I was in the Navy, like, a long time ago, I did a news satire site called The Fake News. And so my Reddit handle is The Fake News. And, like, nobody takes me seriously. I mean, I'm not on Reddit very much. Like, and when I am, most of the time, I'm just reading. I comment very infrequently on it. But when I do, like, it's always like, oh, how can I trust you? And it's like, But fun fact, actually, the fakenews.com, selling that domain paid for this MacBook.
Oh, really?
And, like, $3,000 others worth of stuff.
I mean,
so.
I had to pay for mine with cash. You did good there.
I just went and didn't have a website.
Yeah. So for the longest time on Twitter, I was Jimmy Wellington, which was my like, pen name or whatever. And then, yeah, like, you know, a couple of years ago, actually, like, kind of like when I joined up with Wingin' and Motown, I was like, you know, I mean, who knows if it'll ever lead to, like, a professional job or anything, but at the same time, like, maybe it will. And, you know, I should at least be taking credit for
that. That was the same way. Like, I didn't get on, well, I was on Twitter and I was following analytics people, but I didn't really, like, start getting my name out there. I ran the fan-sided Carolina Hurricanes page for one season, and that was when I started putting my name on stuff, because I was writing a whole lot and doing a whole lot of visuals in Tableau and stuff like that. So I definitely followed that once I started writing for a blog, and then I stopped doing that, but I just kind of kept.
I was actually, the reason my name's there is actually because the managing editor of All About the Jersey, John Fisher, it was a policy for him that all the writers that were writing for All About the Jersey need to use their real names on the articles for the people who, you know.
Which I think is a good policy.
Yeah, I agree.
It obviously kind of sucks, you know, to have people, like, just coming at you saying you're stupid when you write stuff. But, I mean, I think it definitely...
I'm doing this for 5 years.
You get used to it, but I just think it, for me personally, put my name on it, made me put that much extra effort in what I was doing.
You have to own whatever.
Yeah, you got to own. You can't hide behind a Reddit name or you know, troll post or whatever.
If you say something ridiculous, you can't just change the pseudonym and then have a new opinion.
You can't just, like, come out and say, like, trade Connor McDavid for a sixth round and expect to not get clowned on Twitter.
Yeah.
So I think that's a good thing.
Yes, I want to come back to, you know, we were talking about the conversation we were having last night about, you know, sometimes you set out to do something, you realize that, okay, I've made this too complicated. So a personal experience that actually all three of us shared is, you know, a while back I was trying to put something together, like a pretty complicated dashboard compared to, like, pretty easy stuff. And, you know, both of you were super helpful on Twitter and, like, you know, helping me do it. And I think I told you this last night, like, when I was done, I came to the realization that I was like, I don't really like this. You know, like, there's too, like, I tried to do too much. And, like, as a result, like, it's not as useful as I wanted it to be. But at the same time, I do think that I learned a lot. So my question is, you know, since we all make mistakes, it's part of the learning process, right? So you know, what are the best lessons that you've learned from making mistakes? And it could be visualizations, it could be anything else, like hockey related or stats.
You
want
to go first? Or you want
me? Well, I mean, see, it'd be unfortunate for me just because I have a very similar kind of revelation with regards to Viz, because like even if you just look at what's on my tableau right now, you'll see the first one that I had. Had a lot of information on it, right? And it's, I think I still, like, I look back at it and I still think it's, for the information that I wanted to show, it's about as simple as it could have been. But I think I got too hung up with, like, efficiently using the space, trying to show as much information with as little moving parts as possible. And I wasn't, I didn't care enough about making sure that it was immediately intuitive, right? So in the second iteration, my second attempt at this type of thing, you can see like the All Three Zone comparison tool. There's, you know, a bunch of colored bars, and I used a lot of different ways to show the same thing, right? There's an x-axis, there's a colored bar on the x-axis, and it's labeled. All of them, I'm showing the same thing in three different ways, right? It's really redundant. It's not sound statistics to do what I did, but it makes everyone understand really quickly what it is that that viz represents. And that one was the one that people seem to catch on to. So sometimes I need to, you know, put my, you know, statistical or really rigorous analytical mind on the back burner for a second and worry about what it is that will help people understand, as opposed to just what gets the most information out there.
For me, like, if with dealing with failure, I think a very good habit is to own it. Publish your failure.
Mm.
Show people what you did. I mean, at least that way, like, a lot, I mean, it's human nature to try to want to hide that stuff. But I think it leads to a better development, because if you know nice people, you know, obviously not everyone's nice, but if you know people and they see it and you ask them, hey, like, hey, this isn't good, like, what's wrong? You'll get some great feedback. You also can help other people. I think a lot of time in the analytics community, we see all the successes and we don't see like any of the failures, and there's probably like 10 failures to one success. Yeah. For everything you do, you write a script, it like any script I've ever written, there's probably like 30 iterations of it where it's been awful, and then what it comes out is still sort of awful, but at least it works. So I think sharing your failures with people is a good step, because it allows you to get that feedback that you need, because if you're coming out with everything perfect, there's just not a whole lot of room for there.
Yeah, I think an extension of people having a bias towards success is people having a bias towards like profundity or importance, right? So like if you do a study on trying to find correlation between something and you don't find the correlation, publish that study. Don't go hunting for a correlation somewhere, right?
But if you
don't go looking for an R squared.
Yeah, exactly. Right?
So
yeah.
Now you know not to look at that.
Right,
if your R squared is 0.007, yeah. I want to know that because
it's like I thought it was going to be true, but it's not.
Yeah, exactly.
So
it's important.
Like for me, I came up more recently with a prospect model, and it just did not work. Like my whole, I don't know yet why it didn't work. It just didn't work. But I published it. I was like, here it is, you know, so don't do this.
Don't be me.
Don't be me. It was like, basically I'd created these probability buckets and nothing was working out. I don't even know if it was like statistically sound, but it just wasn't good. Or the results weren't good. Even though some of the actual testing, like the AUC, was good, but just the way I put it together just did not work. So I
I'm definitely going to take that advice. I'm going to give next year, I'm going to give one more shot at this award prediction model that I'm working on. And if I can't figure it out that time, I'm just going to publish whatever I have.
Yeah.
Because I think award prediction is really tough because you have such a small sample, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Few players get votes. It might just be that I can't do this. And if I can't, then I'm just going to
show
people.
Yeah, so sometimes you're just not going to model stuff. It's just not
everything
work.
Is
yeah.
that easy.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, I definitely agree with you, and I think that's a really important thing, especially if we have listeners who are maybe just trying to start out getting into anything related to the field in writing or you know, data. It's for most people, it's really hard to ask for honest feedback, because it sucks when somebody tells you that something you worked really hard on is not as good as you thought it is.
It sucks in the moment,
right?
You'll be thankful
that. Like, without that, you're never gonna get what you want to get. You know, it's like you have to be willing to open yourself up. And obviously, you're going to want to find people who are going to be honest with you, but not be like, well, here's why this is a piece of crap. You know, here's why this, I don't know, this is dumb, I don't know why, you know. Yeah, like, yeah. So anytime I write anything that has to do with data, I always try to talk to Prashanth and, like, at, you know, maybe just kind of run my ideas by him or, like, see if he can just read a draft of it. You know, just because he's someone I trust, number one, to know what he's talking about. But number two, if he thinks that there's something that could be better, or if he thinks that this doesn't really work, he's going to tell me. He's not just going to be like, well, I don't want to hurt his feelings. Like, he's going to be nice about it, but he's going to tell me. Yeah. You know, and I think that's really important. So, like, for you guys, like, who do you get feedback from?
Mostly him, okay. Whether I asked for it or not.
Well, that's usually just about, like, your film choices and your general lifestyle. But for me...
And the Evolving Wild.
The Evolving Wild
Yeah,
Twins,
that's probably the...
Are both of those guys, we both kind of started in the analytics around the same time. Like, we both started doing, or kind of first got noticed by working with Dawson's Don't Tell Me About Hearts war models. Like, he did that, and I made a Tableau of them, and then it just took off. Everybody wanted to know about the models, and, like, all these people that I follow started following me back. It was just...
That predated me by, like...
Yeah, it was a good 6 months.
Yeah.
I remember, like, it was at this conference last year that we found out he got... Or no, it was shortly after he got hired by Kroenke.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And I remember we were at McGregor's, and we had the giant, you know, huge, like, Game of Thrones wedding table style table.
We will have a
game. And I ended up sitting directly across from him. I'm like, oh, man, that's him. Like, and I remember talking to Prashanth. I was like, so does this mean that Gar's going away? And Prashanth is like, I have some bad news for you. And I was like, Dawson, I am super happy for you, and I'm also really angry at you. Because I really liked using
that.
There
was no way someone wasn't going to pick up the Gar choice, though, right? Like, it's too much of a desirable statistic.
Yeah. But the thing is, I'm not even sure they may have picked him up for Gar, but I just think he's got a very strong statistical background.
Yeah.
Like, he's one of the first, him and Manny. I mean, obviously, Polsky as well, but they like brought a lot of more rigor to some of these things than
Micah
as well. Yeah.
And actually, I had a flashback the other day when Manny tweeted that if we don't stop arguing about war, he's going to delete his model. Yeah. And I wanted to DM him and be like, "You're joking? You're kidding, right? Please,
like, I'm going to download it right now."
Yeah. Oh, I have it all.
Exactly.
As soon as something comes out, I just download the spreadsheets now because I'm like, at least I have
also
something, you know.
Also, Manny's war model is completely open source and on GitHub as well.
Yeah.
So if you want to run it, you can run it, and that's a big thing too. I guess if we're still talking about new people, one thing I'd like to mention is, like, when you're starting out, like, don't compare yourself to these people that have been doing it forever. It'll be depressing, very
especially not Manny. Do not
because I made this draft project and then Manny comes along and, like, I've been working on this for like 3 months.
Yeah,
obviously I think Manny does this full time, so that helps out, but I'm not saying I'm as smart as Manny, but, like, in 2 or 3 weeks, he's got a model up and it looks much better than anything I was doing. So, like, even I've achieved some small amount of success, and then even still, when I look at, like, people like Manny, people like Matt Cain, people who are even Dawson, like, they've been doing this for years before I even picked up a Tableau.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I mean, it reminds me, like I have in my high school classroom, I have very few posters and stuff up. I do have one thing that is it's a cool, I believe it's by Ira Glass, and the full version is pretty long, but the short version is basically that everybody who wants to do something great always starts off bad, and you know you're bad because you know what good is. Right, and the fact that you know what good is means that there is a chance that you could get there. It's just going to be frustrating because you know where you want to be, you're not there yet. But the only way to get there is to keep going, even when you're failing, even when you're not there. You got to the only way is to put in the work, put in the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Don't
be afraid to suck at something.
Yeah.
Okay. When I was just starting to get used to how to use R to do everything that I wanted to do with it, I was like, I'm going to try to scrape the NHL play-by-play data, right? this is something that I was never going to be able to catch up to Manny and, you know, that everyone who's doing NHL play-by-play scraping. This is a Herculean task for me, relatively new in R at the time, to take on. But the skills that I learned in the process, I still have a functioning play-by-play scraper that I never use because everyone else's is better, right? But the skills that I learned in that process are what were what made me able to deal with all of Corey's data, right? Yeah. So even if it's not, even if the specific task that you're working on, even if you're never going to be the best or succeed in that particular task, the skills that you might learn in the process could be applicable elsewhere.
Sure.
So never let the fear of failure disincentivize a task that you think, even if it just might be interesting, even if it doesn't necessarily have to be helpful.
Yeah,
I gotta agree with that. Like, you just, it's all about the time you put in, to be honest. And obviously, a lot of people, you know, their lives don't have a lot of time. It's more a time sink than it is any sort of I'm smarter than you or they're smarter than you. They've just put in the time. They've just learned it. Like, it is a time sink, and you may not ever catch up to that. But as long as you're enjoying what you're doing, and that's the main thing.
So if you're enjoying it, it won't feel like such a time commitment.
Yeah.
Like how many, like, check out Matt Barlow's Twitter at 3 a.m. on, like, an average weekday, right?
Yeah, like, I'm usually posting something I'm working on. Well, for me, I have a kid, so I don't really, I'm not able to work until after my kid goes to bed. And so it's obviously hard. It's not impossible, but it is much harder that way. Like most of these guys are young. I'm more relatively older.
Ancient. Fossil.
Yes.
Taken into rigor mortis.
And, you know, if it's 3 a.m. and you've been checking that out, you know, check out Chris Watkins' Twitter.
Because
he's going through actively telling you why everything you love is terrible. That's pretty much his brand other than hockey. You know, our podcast has another host, another co-host, Jay, and he's not here. He's in Detroit, but he sent me a few questions, and so I wanted to make sure I got to ask at least one of them. And so I thought this was a really interesting one, right? So his question is, when it comes to data visualization, right, what's your big pursuit? Like, what's your most ambitious way to present something? So, like, if you could be like, I'm going to create the perfect thing, like. What would it be like? What would
I'm just gonna go ahead and say, yeah. I'll start off here. Like, for me, like, I'm more about the communication of the data, and the more I get into that, the more I find anything beyond a bar graph, a line graph, and a scatter plot, like it looks good, but you're not as efficiently communicating your findings as you could be. So
the stacked pie chart one.
Yeah. Oh god. I mean, like there's tons of people that do great visualizations, but there's always that fine line you have between it being effective and it looking good, and it's an axis. It's very hard to do both. And the people that do are, like, amazing at it. Like Rob Tufts is very good at it. Some of the people I mentioned on my slides are in that category as well. But for me, I'm not as artistic of a person, so I just more work towards efficiency to get the data out there so people can make actionable decisions on it.
Yeah, I would say that I feel like if I tried to answer the question too well, like, you know, the pursuit of, like, a perfect viz type thing, I would end up falling into that trap that I fell into originally, which is trying to show too much information, right? The only way that I can see that working is if you have, like, if you create, like, say in Tableau, you can make a dashboard, which is several different things. If you can do that, and when you hover over one piece of data, that piece of data highlights in all four places so that everyone can see where they are in relation to this set of data, where it is in relation to a pie chart, where it is. If you can make it so that the user can navigate it and immediately get perspective from several vantage points, that would be the only way that I would say that I would like to shoot for a way to, you know, put in a lot of data, and it also wouldn't be too complicated because your eye only needs to look at one thing at a time. But then if you want to, you can navigate over to what do they look like in a different context.
Yeah. Also, I'd like to just add on there, like, when making your visualizations, like, you're in control. You're not just putting data out there. Like, you need to tell a story. Like the who mentioned your stats don't talk. You do. Same way with visualizations. You need to set up the stats to tell the story that you want to tell to the people that are viewing. Like, you can add in the interactivity with Tableau and allow people to drill in, but ultimately you need to have a vision for what you're trying to show. And that helps out a lot. It helps reduce clutter and kind of focus in on the important things.
Yeah. All right, I think I have like two more questions. One's more serious, one's a little more fun. So it's always fun to end on like a fun one. But don't get nervous. It's not like a bad one. It's not like I'm going to like pull a prank on you and now we're going to do something. All right, so this is something I'm definitely really interested in, this idea. So with as many versions of different models and things like that now, how do you evaluate whether a model or stat is something that you should pay attention to, right? Because, you know, like, oh, hey, this new thing's out, I'm going to make a visualization. But, like, you're not just like, oh, just because somebody put something out, I'm just going to immediately run and go do it. Because, like, we always talk about Manny, you know, with his Corsica stuff. And I've tried. I don't have enough math background to really follow his explanation. But a lot of people who are way smarter than me, they've read it and they're like, yeah, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. You know, so I like people I trust the methods he's using. You know, so for me, like, I mean, I have to ask somebody else. But like, how do you decide if this new thing is worth paying attention to, or maybe it's something like, maybe, you know, maybe let's not trust that just yet because maybe there's a flaw in the process or something like that.
More of a slightly more modeler than
yeah. For me, the main thing for me is how open they are with their processes and their data.
Yeah,
like you can come out if you come out and say this is proprietary. I don't want to share this. This is, I'm trying to make money off that. I respect that. You know, like, yeah, I still respect your decision. And that's, they're still important to look at that too. But people who come out with stuff and just kind of like say, oh, I'm going to do a write-up or this, they don't really show like any correlation matrices or, you know, just a general write-up what their process is, what their thought process is for you to criticize it. That's a big red flag for me. And I'm not saying everyone that does this is out to, you know, pull the hood, hoodwink
you. People
are busy, but for me, if I don't have a write-up to at least look at, I may not understand it all, then I'm going to favor something else that I can study and look at how the decisions they've made affects the outputs of the model.
Yeah, as another example, the way that his he had several writers, I think three or four articles, but Harry Schomer, Offsides Review, when he published his expected goals model, he had how it performed against some other ones that we know. In addition to just straight shots or weighted Fenwick, I think was also there.
Yeah.
So he had like a full list of how it compared to everything that we know today. So I think in that way, you don't, it kind of takes out this factor of, you know, you're asking like, how do you trust new information? I was like, well, he's showing it, right? Like he's showing why we should or shouldn't trust it. And if you look through the stats, right, like it just didn't like overperform, right, in every metric, right? It's not like his was the best and this was just, you know, shameless self-promotion, right? There were places where it didn't help.
That would probably raise red flags, right? Because
yeah, if you were the best in everything, you'd
Be like, hey, this is unbelievable. You know, I mean, like for me, I'd be like, it sounds too good to be true, and buyer beware. Let's be really careful of this. And you know, again, I would talk to my friends who know a lot more than I do, and I'd be like, hey, so is it really this good, or like what's going on with this?
One quick thing, I just want to go ahead and plug Offsides Review. If you don't know about it, it's a great site. Harry Schomer is very smart. He's like a lesser known Manny that works in Python, in my opinion. He's a really smart guy.
Yeah, I used his I used Offsides Review, his website, for the RITSEC presentation that I just did, actually, because he lets you he has basically game logs. He aggregates by game as opposed to just by season or by date span, which is what Natural Stat Trick and Corsica allow you to do. So he's excellent
resource out there. It's just a little different than the other guys, but also has XG and stuff like that.
All right, so just to wrap it up. Like I said, I mean, obviously this whole conversation has been like fun and positive and all that stuff, but just in case I always want to end on like a positive note, right? So since I've gotten to know the two of you on Twitter from interacting and things like that, so the two of you definitely spend a lot of time needling each other on Twitter, right? So what's the one thing you each most appreciate about the other person?
I thought we were going to go the opposite way.
No,
I
know.
I was all ready to just like completely.
No, because we already know the other
Absolutely
one.
Absolutely nothing.
We already know the other one.
So he's already talked about it a lot.
It's like, this is an intervention, by the way. No,
he's already talked about it a little bit today, but there's kind of two big things, which is the, you know, how open he is with all of his processes, and that kind of feeds into a larger thing, which is that all of his tutorials. I think he's one of the greatest education sources in the hockey analytics community right now, with the just like the you know, list of different tutorials. And he's, you know, he's helped me, he's helped Andy, he's helped you,
yeah,
right? Like,
absolutely.
There's a lot of different people that would not be in analytics or would not be known in analytics today if it wasn't for his openness and how much, like I messaged him, I don't know, probably like 7-8 times just to create my first mediocre tableau,
yeah,
right? And he had no reason to help me,
yeah,
but he did.
Yeah,
so.
And I mean, I can second that, you know, I mean, like, mm-hmm. you, and it's funny because I remember, like, obviously, on the one hand, I was like, oh, this, it's really awesome that this guy's helping me. Like this is great. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, like, I don't want to just be like, ask him to do it for me. You know, mm-hmm. like I really want, like, before I ask the next question, I want to have tried to figure it out on my own.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then if I have to, I'm like, oh, hey, okay, what about this? And, like, mm-hmm. you know, so Matt, you definitely had a positive impression on me in that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can definitely second what you said.
He has terrible taste in movies, though.
Yeah. those are very kind words.
You just couldn't help yourself.
No way.
To be honest, CJ, like, I just really like interacting with him. Mm-hmm. Like, he's a guy, like, I consider a friend on Twitter, even though this is the first time we met.
Yeah.
He's great to interact with. He's always positive with his sort of feedback if you ever need it. He's got stats background, which I don't. So if I ever have a stats question, I can always go to him. Because he's a master in statistics, correct? He's just an all-around, general, nice guy, other than his awful taste and everything.
Yeah.
But, see, like, he's, sometimes you just meet people on Twitter, and you kind of, like, even though we need each other, at least for me, like, it's comfortable, at least.
Yeah.
And just, and so I've just enjoyed talking to him, discussing stats with him. And it's always nice to, you know, for me, I put a thing up on Google Sheets a while ago, like, good hockey Twitter follows. Like, you want to cultivate other people who are fans of other teams. There's, because it's impossible to watch 31 teams. And, like, CJ is my Devils guy. Like, he, if I need to know something about the Devils, I go to him. And you just kind of, like, Prashanth would be my Red Wings guy. You know, and they're spread throughout the league.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think if you're getting the analytics, you need to build these relationships, because it is impossible to watch all 30.
Yeah.
The Twins, after they made their war model, right?
Yeah.
Like, they asked me, like, does this make sense?
Yeah.
As Devils. So, like, so if you cultivated these types of relationships, then after you've done your own research, you can ask around and be like, does this make sense? Is this stupid? I don't know this team enough, right? Like, so it's
Because they'll ask me, they showed me the Canes.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Stuff.
Same idea. I was like, it's disappointing because Damon Severson's not good on this model. But I guess,
you see some weird stuff, too, in advance, and you know, like, what people are going to complain about.
Oh,
And I can feel like an insider when I post it. All the wild to get to be released, Gars.
But no, CJ's been great, though. We haven't, like, I guess technically worked together other than me helping him with Tableau, but he's been very helpful in like, promoting me as well, because right now I don't do a whole lot of original research or hockey analytics. I just kind of do my own thing. And he was kind of one of the first people, like, when his viz took off, he gave me all the credit, or not all the credit, but tons of credit with helping with it.
Your lion's share of the credit.
which he didn't need to do, and was very appreciated. And there was a couple people today in RISAC that gave me shout outs that I really had little to nothing to do with what they were doing, but it was just very nice.
Like I said, but that's my point, is that if I don't do that, then other people don't know who to ask, right? Everyone else now knows that they can ask him about random things, right? I think the hockey community, the hockey analytics community as a whole, generally does a pretty good job of promoting within, other people who are doing good things get known.
That's true, and I do agree with that. But, like, with my niche, what I do, when I started out, I found, like, helping that beginner going from beginner to someone who can do things, that was kind of like a wasteland when I first started.
Agreed.
So I'm glad people are getting more into analytics, and whatever little part I've had to do with that is definitely very humbling.
Yeah.
So.
Nice. Well, I mean, I think it's definitely a really good, positive way to end it. Thank you very much again. I think I forgot to say Matt's Twitter handle before, so I'm just going to say both of them. All right, so Matt Barlow is MATT_Barlow, BARLOWE,
Can't forget the E.
Exactly, yeah. Because it's always like, is it one T or two T? Is it, you know?
Yeah, there's another guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, actually, I have a Canadian doppelganger who's Matt Barlow.
Yeah.
Like, he's from Canada, and he currently lives in the States, and I, like, found him randomly just looking at someone's Twitter thread, and I was like, hey, you're my Canadian twin.
And people were like, what's that hockey guy? Oh, he's Canadian. He must be the hockey guy.
Yeah, and like, he liked hockey, and it was like, we're very simple. Like, we don't, like, interact that much, but follow each other.
We've interrupted your sign-off.
No, it's okay.
Talking about my Twitter twin. Yeah. It's like, twins and friends. Yeah.
I mean, I always think the interviews are more the most interesting for our guests when people are genuinely enjoying interacting with each other. And, I mean, obviously you guys do, and, you know, from me talking to you guys. So I don't forget, CJ is at CJTDevil on Twitter. So Matt and CJ, thank you both so much.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks
awesome.
For having us. I was going to do one more plug, but it's all
good. You can do it if you want.
Oh, I was just going to plug my website.
Yeah, go for it.
Barlow,
yeah.
Like, they're speaking of the tutorials, barlowanalytics.com. You can find all my tutorials there. I've kind of slowed down because I've got other projects, but I'm hoping to pick back up once the season starts.
Yeah. And CJ, remind me, what's the name of the Devils?
All about the jersey.
Okay, cool. I was pretty sure, but I wasn't 100% sure, and I figured...
I think I mentioned it at some point in the middle, so...
Nice. All right, so thanks a lot.
That's some great stuff from our roving road reporter, Mr. Pete Flynn, and awesome insight into what Ritzak has to offer. And be sure to check out the Ritzak site. It's rit.edu/science/moneypuck. For those of you who are big NHL players, you'll hear the term money puck and either be struck with excitement or fear, because that means either the game is going to be over for you or for the person playing against you. Once again, I'd like to thank our guests, Mr. Matt Kane, Mr. Matt Barlow, Mr. CJ Turturro. You can follow Mr. Kane at Kane_Matt. Once again, another person who never has to worry about finding a classic handle. You can follow Matt at Matt_Barlow. Jeez, that's a twofer in the awesome handle department that doesn't require any sort of magic character limit or signs or emojis. And then you can also follow CJ at CJTDevil. Devil obviously means he is a huge, huge New York Rangers fan. Just kidding. That would be the Devils. So that wraps up another fun episode of For Sure, a 200-Foot Podcast. You can always follow our nonsense online at 200-Foot Pod. That's at 200-FTPOD. You can also follow Pete Flynn at PFlynnHockey. That is exactly how it is spelled. And then you can follow me as well, you know, if you just don't have anything else going on, at TheRoar_24. We also know you like merch, so tinyurl.com/forshirt. I'm pretty sure I'm saying that correctly because, you know, Pete likes to say it all the time. It's a fantastic shirt. There are a lot of shirts out there that sound neat and could be neat, but they aren't, because they aren't the For Shirt, because it's our name and it's a shirt put together. So, once again, thank you for listening, and we'll be back at you soon. Hockey season is coming. Hockey season's coming.